All right, welcome to PSI. So it's my privilege to be your first lecturer this year. And so I'm going to teach you a very brief course on complex analysis. And it's only four lectures long. And this is not going to be mathematically rigorous in any sense. It's supposed to be a review of some of the concepts that you'll probably see this year. Mostly for PSI, you'll need to do contour integrals. But we're going to just build up to that contour integrals, and you may need some ideas of analytic continuation. Now, in previous years, I didn't cover analytic continuation. This year, I'll try to squeeze it in somehow. So these are the books that I like. So this course will be very much like the first book, which is a very sort of bare bones outline book on complex analysis. So it doesn't go into deep, it doesn't go deep into the theory, but has like a bunch of problems. So the level of depth in my course will be similar to that, although the material will not be from various other places. This second book, Ablowitz and Foukas, Complex Analysis and Application, that's probably a good example of a typical undergraduate book, but it's about 500 pages long. So, it's got a lot of material. It's a very nice book to read. The third book, which I like very much, is a relatively new book by William T. Shaw, which is Complex Analysis with Mathematica. And this is a book written entirely with Mathematica. And the book comes with a DVD or a CD, I guess, with all the chapters as Mathematica files. And all the pictures there have been generated by Mathematica. And below every picture, the code for generating that picture is given. And because, it's a book about Mathematica as well as complex analysis, if you're interested in, like, coming, into all these fancy diagrams that you can draw with complex analysis, for example, the Mandelbrot set and stuff like that, that's a book to go. And if you want to have a leisurely read about, the exciting world of geometry, how geometry intersects with complex analysis, intersects with twisters and stuff like that, you can consult Roger Penrose's book, The Road to Reality. I put the lectures up on the SciWiki, the first lecture. The lectures, every year I find mistakes. So I, yesterday I sometime, I found a bunch of typos yesterday. So I corrected them and put them up again. But, it's not the end of the world. I'm missing an I here or there, things like that. Okay, so, a little bit of history. So complex numbers were first discovered, or rather, stumbled upon by Rolando. Is it Rolando or Ronaldo? I don't know. Cardano in the 16th century. He was an Italian mathematician. I can verify that. So just because he's dead and, no, it's Rolando, okay. Just because he's dead and long gone doesn't mean I have to misspell his name, right? So he was trying to solve this particular equation, which is a quadratic equation. And he found that the solutions, he had to consider the square root of negative numbers. And that's how complex numbers entered mathematics. He tried to avoid it, and apparently in his book, he kind of tries to kind of shove it under the carpet, but there was no escaping the fact that they were there. Apparently the guy is also got in trouble with the law of the day because he drew up the horoscope of Jesus Christ. But he should have stuck to mathematics more, I guess. That's one way of looking at it, because if you have a quadratic equation, and I don't know a lot of formulae in mathematics, but I know this one. The dogs have an opinion on this lecture. if the coefficient of the quadratic equation satisfies this, we all know that the solutions involve complex numbers. So one way of looking at complex numbers is that they arose because we needed to solve a very general set of, algebraic equations. So, namely, the quadratic equation. And you can think of the history of numbers in that way. Negative numbers came because, or negative integers came because we wanted to solve a general equation. And then, then the rational. Although, this doesn't really give you all the irrational numbers, because there are certain irrational numbers, a lot of them, who do not arise as solutions to algebraic equations, such, the transcendental numbers like pi, e, funky numbers like that. But, one way of looking at, just for the sake of discussion, if you say that, okay, complex numbers, arose because we needed to solve the quadratic equation, then the natural question would be that, do we need something more general, say, to solve the most general algebraic, polynomial equation? And the answer is no. Complex numbers are enough. And that's such an important result that it has a name, which is called the fundamental theorem of algebra. So it turns out that complex numbers allow you to take arbitrary roots of arbitrary numbers. So they're extremely general. So, historically, although complex numbers were, discovered in the context of a quadratic equation, they could have discovered in the context of a cubic equation, except that it would have been a quadratic part of a cubic equation anyway. But that's, so if you factor it out, so anyway. So at some point, when we discuss the roots of complex numbers, we'll gain more intuition as to why, they are enough for solving, general arbitrary polynomial equations. So why do we need complex numbers? So why do you guys think we need complex numbers? Can anyone tell me? Whatever, or like for everyday life, or whatever, it's like, it's a very open-ended question. Apart from, okay, physics is a good idea, yes. Sorry? Yeah, that's a good answer, yes.
Because they have like very interesting structure that is kind of very useful in a lot of branches of physics.
Right. And?
They help unify like exponentials and sinusoidal functions.
Yes? You have an answer?
I would think that you could do things like quantum mechanics without them, obviously, if you wanted to, but probably their completeness makes them useful because you always have eigenstates and stuff like that.
Right. So you'd think that you can do quantum mechanics without them, but the answer is no. So you'd think that, okay, I have some, some psi, and I can always write as real and imaginary and just kind of, have this clunky thing and just, divide the Schrodinger equation into its real part and imaginary part. But it turns out that, you can't do that because the Schrodinger equation, it's like a heat equation, right? Except it's complex. So if you think of the heat equation, the real heat equation, it's not reversible under, time reversal. So the heat equation has an inherent, arrow of time built into it, Whereas if you look at the microscopic world of the interaction of particles, you know, there is no obvious direction of time. And in fact, you know, so the fact that Schrodinger equation is a reversible, it's a reversible equation, is intimately related to the fact that it's actually a complex equation. And people who study the foundations of quantum mechanics, they have tried to do quantum mechanics over the reals. So you know, you consider Hilbert spaces which are not on the complex numbers, right? In quantum mechanics, we are told that, you know, we have to work with the Hilbert space where psi is, you know, they're linear you can take linear combination over the complex numbers. But if you restrict yourself to the real numbers, there are operations like charge conjugation and time reversal, you know, which we know we have to do in order to describe, you know, particle physics, quantum. You cannot do them in terms of that you're not allowed in real quantum mechanics. And not only that, like some of the, you know, quantum foundation people will tell you that some of the operations that you can do with complex wave functions, you can't really do that. Like entanglement properties are different for real quantum mechanics as opposed to complex quantum mechanics, yes?
When you're talking about the Hamiltonian being time invariant, time reversal, and this requiring complex numbers, does this have anything to do with time reversal being anti-unitary, or
yes, I mean the whole notion of unitarity is related to you know, the fact that we are dealing with complex wave functions, and that and the most general transformations allowed on your Hilbert space that preserve probability are unitary or, you know, anti-unitary. So yes, so there are formulations of I think quantum mechanics. Are those the PT symmetric quantum mechanics? No, I think even they deal with
imaginary eigenvalues themselves.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So yeah, but there are people who work on real quantum mechanics. They study real quantum mechanics. You know, anyway, this is just to kind of, you know, improve a point. And also, like, mathematics is, like, you know, if you're a pure mathematician and you're doing analysis, analysis is very awkward without complex numbers. You know, you can do real analysis without reference to any complex numbers, but having access to complex numbers allows you to have additional insights. So, for example, you know, we all know that, you know, this particular series diverges for converges only for, you know, inside the unit disk, right? Well, we are considering it as a real series, so, you know, between minus one and plus one. But we can identify this, say, as the Taylor series of that function. And now if I consider this function as a complex function, then we know that, you know, on the complex plane, this guy has singularities, has poles as plus I and minus I. And Taylor's theorem tells you that the Taylor series converges inside a circle, right? So according to Taylor's theorem, you know, if you take the Taylor series of this function around the origin, it'll only converge in a circle which goes up to the first singularity that you meet. And that's kind of an alternative way of looking at why this guy, you know, converges, you know, in this limit. You know, you can use all the convergent tests, and that's valid too. But this gives you an additional insight into it's a more elegant and geometric way of looking at, you know, why such functions behave the way that they do. And then, of course, life. You know, one of the most exciting branches of mathematics is number theory. And so number theory has a very famous function, which was introduced by the complex version of it was introduced by Riemann, yes. And this guy only, you know, converges for the real part of Z greater than 1. Now, in physics, often as this series crops up, especially when you have to deal with the vacuum energy or something called the Casimir energy or the Casimir force of the vacuum, or when you're calculating the dimensions of space-time and string theory. And this series goes on forever, and you know, and because it's a divergent series, you know, you're not allowed to sum it. You're not allowed to take this, you know, just add it up. And but you can, by using a technique of complex analysis known as analytic continuation, you know, you can identify the series to. Well, first of all, you can identify the series to this particular value of the Riemann zeta function. But just because Riemann zeta function, this representation is valid in a certain range, doesn't mean that it doesn't exist in other parts of the complex plane. And by using a technique in complex analysis called analytic continuation, you can analytically continue this, you know, to of the value where the argument is minus 1, and it turns out the value of the Riemann zeta function over there is 1 over minus 1 over 12. So this is kind of a very famous result. And so if you are interested in why we can't, you know, add up divergent series like this, or why, you know, what kind of breaks down when you're adding up divergent series, you know, I would recommend that you look into a book by, I think it's, what's his name? Hardy. Yes. Hardy, or look at the lectures by Carl Bender from a few years ago. You know, the Psi lectures. So you can't really do number theory without the Riemann zeta function. Or you can't really do, you know, it's also extremely important in quantum field theory. Okay, we have already talked about applications to Schrodinger's equation and quantum mechanics, but quantum mechanics is nothing but the non-relativistic approximation to quantum field theory. So what is quantum field theory? Quantum field theory deals with the situation where you have lots of particles and the total number of particles, interacting particles, are not fixed. Now, I said that, you know, Schrodinger's equation is the non-relativistic approximation of quantum field theory, but that's not exactly true, because quantum field theory can also describe non-relativistic systems which have, say, large degrees of freedom, for example, condensed matter system. And there, the quantum field theory you need doesn't have to be relativistic. So in some sense, quantum field theory is kind of a very general setup which allows you to deal with quantum systems which have large number of degrees of freedom. And however, you know, relativistic quantum field theories have kind of a special place in our heart, because we believe that, quote unquote, the fundamental, you know, particles are described by some sort of relativistic quantum field theory, and if you want to, and their mathematical structure is elucidated only when you look into them, you know, into their analytic structure. So quantum field, so you have to actually. So you actually have to look into so you basically have to have complex numbers. So, you know, one of the one of the basic observables in quantum field theory is called an S matrix. And you have to look into their analytic, how the S matrix behave as a function of the complex momenta of the particles. And a lot of the mathematical properties of quantum field theories come about, come out when you do that. In fact, you know, there are people here, like Freddy Cattazzo, who's kind of working on some of the analytic structures. But this program has been around for 40, 50 years, you know. It starts and then, you know, people run into roadblocks and then for 10, 20 years, they say, oh, that just didn't do anything for us. Then they do something else and then somebody discovers something new and then they go into it again. So, psych research. Okay. So you'd think that classical relativity, GR, doesn't have to do anything with complex numbers. Do you think that's true? Sorry?
Except when you do the maximal analytical
extension
for Kruskal.
So, you know, at some point you will be taught about black holes by Ruth Gregory, and she will draw a diagram like this. This is known as a Penrose, a Carter-Penrose diagram. And so the classical equations of general relativity, when you solve them, you know, this is, okay, let me back up. So the first non-trivial, one of the first non-trivial solutions of Einstein's equation was discovered by Karl Schwarzschild. And later people realized that it actually describes a black hole. So what Karl Schwarzschild did is that he found a spherically symmetric solution of Einstein's equation, but he only found the solution in part of the space-time. So he found the solution outside the event horizon. And then later people found coordinate transformation which allowed you to go inside the event horizon. And then one way of describing these space-times, the causal structure of the space-time is by using what is known as a Penrose diagram, which preserves the angles between light rays, but it doesn't preserve the distance on that space. So Schwarzschild basically discovered this part of the solution. And then people found a coordinate transformation to go beyond the event horizon. And here's a singularity. And then people realize that you can actually, if you consider the metric as an analytic function, you know, what is the, then there is actually a white hole, you know, hiding in the past. This is not a physical description of a physical black hole, but it's the mathematical property of the black hole solution. And then there is another causally separate universe, and which you can't really go from this universe to this universe because light rays travel here at 45 degrees and you can't travel faster than the speed of light or something. So this is the complete solution of the complete picture of the Schwarzschild solution. And this is, you get to that by doing what is known as a maximal analytic continuation, you know, of the original solution. So I'm just gonna, you know, if you want to know more about this, there is a review paper quite old by now by Brill called Aspects of Analyticity, and he's the one who looked into this kind of stuff. There are other papers on the web by him, so you can have a look. Now, you know, that's kind of a fancy mathematical thing, and you'd say, okay, I'm a physicist, I don't really care. You know, what I care about is the real black hole solution, the black hole that collapses, that forms from the collapse of a star, and that's what I'm interested in. So, you know, okay, I'm fine with you, but then you have to come into the realm of quantum gravity. And we still don't know what quantum gravity is. We still don't know what kind of path integral it's going to be. But there's an old proposal by a by a Cambridge school, by the Cambridge school, called Euclidean Quantum Gravity. Hawking and his collaborators and their students developed it in the 70s and early 80s. It's kind of died off as its independent school of thought, but it actually survived in disguise within M theory. And the idea is that what Hawking said that, okay, you end up with some three-dimensional space, you begin with some three-dimensional space, and what to describe the universe, you sum over all the histories. So you're summing over geometries which connect these spaces. And the path integral that is needed, it's actually a Euclidean path integral, and the analytic properties of that path integral are extremely important. So, you know, a lot of complex analysis goes in there. And why I say that this still exists is that there is a branch of string theory which has now become its own field called ADS-CFT, where you compute something on a boundary conformal field theory, and that is supposed to be dual to a quantum gravity living in the bulk, except that the quantum gravity living in the bulk, we can't really do that quantum gravity because it's very hard, it's strongly coupled, but we can do an approximation, which is like a kind of a saddle point approximation. And that saddle point approximation that we do, all the techniques that one uses is actually just borrowed from Euclidean quantum gravity. So okay. And then, you know, something that I don't know a lot about, but I like is Penrose at some point formulated the physics of massless particles in curved space-time in terms of these funky objects called twisters. And twisters have had a huge impact on mathematics and theoretical physics. There's a twister string theory now. Twister techniques are being used for quantum field theory. So, and twisters, what they do is that they they complexify. Okay, how should I put this? Okay, let's just say that twisters use complex numbers in an essential way. So, okay, this is a really incomplete list because I can go on forever and you guys can go on forever, and this is like, but I'm just gonna end with one more examples, and that's kind of string theory. And in string theory, you have, you know, in particle physics, you have Feynman diagrams like this, right? So when you're computing processes, you know, scattering processes, you do stuff like this. And what string theory does is that it replaces them by strings propagating. You know, like babies' onesies, except no hole for head. So, but the path integral of string theory, so this is what is known as a Riemann surface. It's a two-dimensional surface which has some kind of a complex structure on it. And the string theory path integral is actually sum over that complex integral, that complex structure. So built into the structure of string theory is the fact that you have to deal with a complex manifold. So that's one obvious application of complex analysis in string theory. String theory also requires 10 space-time dimension, which comes from using this sum at some point. So 10 is equal to 4 plus 6, and 4 being our space-time dimension, so you have to hide the extra 6 dimensions. The preferred geometry of this compact 6 dimension is a space called Calabi-Yau manifolds, or their generalizations, and Calabi-Yau manifolds are complex manifolds. This is a whole new branch of geometry known as complex geometry, and you can't, I mean, like there can be two manifolds, can be equivalent to each other as real manifolds, but not as complex manifolds. Because complex transformations, as we shall see, are much more restrictive. And so you can do coordinate transformations such that which are allowed as real coordinate transformation, but not as complex coordinate transformations. So Calabi-Yau manifolds are, so let me just write that. So Calabi-Yau manifolds are complex manifolds but their complex structure is something that is deformable, and a Calabi-Yau manifold that's over here need not have exactly the same complex structure as the Calabi-Yau manifold is here, but they have to be they have to be you know related continuously. So you can deform the Calabi-Yau manifold, the complex structure, so that the Calabi-Yau manifold here, the complex structure merges smoothly with this. But that, you know, variation of the complex structure manifests itself as a field in our four-dimensional space-time. So these complex structures are actually, you know, you can actually experimentally see them. You know, they're measurable. Yes.
Does that mean there's some kind of topological, a topological winding number of the universe?
Right. I mean, if you believe in this string theory picture, then Calabi-Yau manifolds have holes in them, and these holes can have two dimensions or four dimensions or three dimensions, and strings cannot wrap around them because they'll shrink to a point. But in string theory, there are higher dimensional objects called brains. So brains can wrap around them. And brains can wrap, not only can brains wrap around them, and if the hole is too big, the brain's vibrational modes won't be seen by low energy effective theory. But if somehow, you know, this handle kind of pinches off, then the brain that is wrapping around it, you know, it'll take very little energy to excite that vibrational mode. And you'll get new degrees of freedom. But what is interesting is that the topology of the Calabi-Yau manifold can change. And the brains kind of mediate this change in topology. And so you can actually roll about the vacua of Calabi-Yau manifold. And that's a very interesting branch of physics / mathematics. And that is the original landscape. You know, right before the landscape became big news, in the early 2000s, that landscape has been there for us always. I don't exactly know what you mean, but yeah, I mean, it'll have all these fields will contribute their own energy to the vacuum. But if you have a supersymmetric theory, then the cosmological constant should be zero. I mean, string theory doesn't really solve the cosmological constant problem. Supersymmetry does, and by extension, string theory does because of that. But then, you know, we have to break supersymmetry, so it really doesn't. So we don't know how to naturally break that. Okay, so I love waffling, but as all good things, my waffling has to come to an end. So I actually have to do some work now. Okay, but I'm kind of, you know, guessing that most of you will know what is in the first lecture, so it's good to waffle. It kind of, you know, puts me in the mood. Oh God. This presets. Okay, that's good. You know, like I found a bug in these presets. Like even this tiny machine has a bug in it, this software. No. Okay, so what are the basics? So the basics is that we can associate an ordered pair. So every complex number can be thought of as a pair of ordered numbers And so the algebra of complex numbers is the same as the algebra of the real numbers with the added, you know, what you do is, so it's basically, you know, it's a commutative, associative, you know, division algebra with the fact that I square will give you minus one. However, we have a few more extra operations. For example, there is something called a complex conjugation. So by the way, I'll just breeze through some stuff, but if you think that you want me to like stop and say more, I will. Yes. Well, it allows division. But you know, that's actually a very non-trivial restriction, because if you say, okay, I want a division algebra, but not necessarily commutative, then you get the quaternions. Because you know, in quaternions, you've got I, J, K, right? So you know, I times J is K, blah, blah. So it's not commutative, but it's associative. And you say, okay, if I want division algebra, but not commutative, not associative, then you get the octonions. And so if you say, okay, I don't want any of these things, then what kind of, you know, well, anyway, then you, the, so, okay, what I want to say is that there are only four divisional algebras, the real numbers, the complex numbers, the quaternions, the octonions. And if you want to know about the quaternions are easy. It's a little bit like SU2, and quaternions are used by computer scientists, who work in graphics. You know, people who design like the shooter games. You know, all the rotations, they're done by quaternions. And but if you want to know more about the octonions, you know, John Baez has a really nice article. So. So John Baez, I think it's on the archive. That's a really nice article on. Okay, so we have complex conjugation, and the complex conjugation, what it does is that it just flips the sign of I. So wherever you see an I, you just go and change the sign. That is the operation of complex conjugation. So if we call this Z, the notation that I will be using is Z bar. Sometimes I'll use Z star. And then division so division, you think that, you know, let's just show that division, you know, keeps you within the complex number. So Z1 is some complex number, and you're dividing by another complex number. So the way to see that this is also has the same form as a real plus I times another real number is to do something to this number which is known as rationalization. So what you do is that you take the denominator and its complex conjugate, and you multiply the numerator and the denominator by the same number. So you're multiplying by one. So you're multiplying by one. And now if you just work this out, it's something like x1, x2 plus y2, y1 divided by x2 squared plus y2 squared plus I minus x1, y2 plus y1, x2 squared plus y2 squared. Okay, let me just take a little break and ask our friends Mariana, can you hear me? Okay, so feel free to speak up, okay? So now I get it. That was Mariana's dog. So this is the real part of the x of the complex number is called the real part of the complex number. The y part is called the imaginary part of the complex number. And very confusingly, the imaginary part of a complex number is a real number. Okay. So as we see that here, you know, this is a real number, this is a real number, this is I. So yeah, division does preserve the structure of complex number. Okay. So unlike the real numbers, complex numbers are not, they don't form a ordered set. But you can form what is the, you can define what is known as a modulus to determine the size of a complex number, and that's given by, that's defined by taking this. And if I write it out in terms of the real and imaginary part, this is what it is. For example, you know, if I take the number and this other number, they are distinct numbers because the real part of Z1 and Z2 are different, but their modulus are the same. Okay. So, you know, it's very suggestive, the fact that we have written this complex numbers in this way is very suggestive, because then we should really like think of them as living on a plane, right? X being one axis, Y being another axis. And that plane is known as the Argand-Wessel plane. Okay, what am I gonna do here? Rear, front goes up, middle, mid. So this is the starting of an exciting, you know, so that there's a lot of geometry hidden in complex number. And to see that, you have to, and it'll be interesting to write a complex analysis book which doesn't have any pictures. You know, it'll probably be almost impossible. it's like, I think it's a French novelist. Who wrote a novel, French novel, which doesn't have the letter H. You know, one of the very important letters in French. And apparently it's a good novel. I don't read French, but, you know, so it could be a challenge, you know, write a book on complex analysis without any pictures. Okay, so the Argand-Wessel plane. So when I first read Roger Penrose's book, The Emperor's New Mind, he called it the Argand plane. But when I looked at Road to Reality, he calls it the Argand-Wessel plane. So I guess historians of mathematics have discovered that Wessel also did discover the plane independently. So a complex number is, you know, suppose this is our complex number. So, you know, we can think of every complex number as a vector from the origin. So this is the real axis, and this is the imaginary axis. And one sits here, and I sits here. Now, so the addition of complex numbers, two complex numbers, Z1 and Z2, can be thought of in terms of vector addition. So what comes, so the addition is very, very easy to think, you know, there's nothing new there. But what comes next is new, because you can actually have a geometrical interpretation of the multiplication of two complex numbers. And if you think a little bit, this is what it is. So this guy, so you can think of Z1 as, say, so this is, suppose this is Z1. So let me just draw a triangle which involves the origin 1 and Z1. And suppose that, I'm going to have problem. Okay. And suppose this is Z2. Then the number Z1 and Z2 is the tip of the triangle. So if you draw a triangle with 0, Z2, and some number such that the triangle is similar to this triangle, then the tip of that triangle is given by Z1 times Z2. So that's an interpretation of the general multiplication. You needn't really, when we go over to the polar representation of complex numbers, you'll see that it's there. When you think in terms of polar representation, it'll be much more easy to think about how multiplication affects, how to think geometrically about multiplication. So don't worry about this. This is just to kind of introduce the notion of multiplication. And then the other thing is the complex conjugation can be thought of as reflection along the real axis. That's and multiplication by I can be seen as a rotation in the counterclockwise direction by 90 degrees. So when you say rotation by counterclockwise by 90 degrees, you say, oh, can we find a complex number by which can we find a complex number, which can rotate another complex number at an arbitrary angle,
right,
by multiplication? So to see that yes, that's true. Okay, I'm gonna move over there because that corner is not visible by the whole class. And these big erasers are kind of tricky. They explode on you. So I'm going to use one of the small ones. Okay, so now it should be obvious that if I call this angle theta and the length r, so r is a positive number, then we can represent the complex number as r cosine of theta plus I r sine of theta. Now, if you use the Taylor expansion of cosine and sine function, and use the fact that I squared is minus 1, then you can do something very remarkable. You can rewrite this as R times a series, which looks like this. N goes from 0 to infinity, and the series is, there's a theta here, there's an I divided by factorial of N raised to the power N. So also, So this is a series that we usually employ this notation. So this formula, which is r cosine of theta plus I sine of theta, is, you know, or I should just delete the r, is I to the power theta. This is known as the Euler formula. And many mathematicians and physicists have spent, have kind of, you know, gushed about the beauty of this. So let me spare you of that gushing. Except that I'll tell you an interesting story you may or may not know. This was used to insult Denis Diderot by Euler. Euler was the court mathematician of Catherine the Great of Russia. You know, back in the day, you know, kings and queens used to have, you know, like a court jester. They would have a court mathematician. Mathematician, entertain me. Yeah. So I think Diderot, who was, you know, a novelist, the first person to, the first encyclopedist in history, and, you know, and a man of letters, he also had a reputation of being an atheist. And I think Catherine the Great wanted Euler to insult him for being an atheist. And Euler said, e to the power I pi plus 1 equals to 0, therefore God exists. And apparently, Diderot didn't know enough mathematics to come up with a witty comeback. So having told this story is probably apocryphal, because Diderot, being an encyclopedist, probably knew a lot of mathematics. So, you know, Diderot is one of my favorite novelists. So you should all read, you know, Jacques Le Fatalist. It's a great novel. Anyway. Okay, so the Euler formula is periodic in theta, right? So the theta, it's called the argument of the, so if I take z, and so we can define, so this is basically theta. It's known as the argument of a complex number. But now, if we extend the domain of theta from 0 to 2 pi to the real line, then, you know, then z becomes a, you know, this is a periodic function of theta. So the argument of z is then a multiple valued object. There are multiple values of theta which will give me the same z, right? So this is the beginning. This innocuous looking fact is the beginning of a very, very rich sort of, you know, vein. So we can define what is known as the principal argument. So principal argument of a complex number is that value of theta which lies between 0 to 2 pi. So we can denote this by theta p, and then the number z can be represented by r e to the power I theta of p plus 2 pi of n, where n is an integer. Okay. So e to the power I 2 pi n is plus 1. So it doesn't change the value of z. But the value of theta that lies between 0 to 2 pi is what we called the principal value of the argument. So the Euler formula allows us to almost trivially prove
Your formula for your principle, or the formula you have with z equals r e to the I of theta p plus 2 pi n,
right.
That doesn't matter whether or not you've chosen the principle argument. It's
right.
Still true.
Yeah. Okay. It's true in general. So, you know, Euler's formula allows us to prove an interesting result in complex analysis, which actually came before Euler. And that's known as de Moivre's theorem. And depending on which book you consult, it has different versions. So de Moivre's theorem tells you that for an integer n, this is true. For an integer n, this is true. There are caveats when n is not an integer, but a real number. And that's what we come to next. So to see these sort of why n is not an integer, this formula is not valid, let's consider trying to solve, say, suppose you're given a complex number w, and you're asked to find the nth root of this number. So you're asked to solve z for this equation. So one way of doing this is to say, okay, I can omega, you know, w omega is given, and omega I can write this as some r, which is positive e to the power, you know, I principal value plus 2 pi k, where k is an integer. Then to find the nth root, you take the nth root of the real number, and then here you divide this by n. And you see that for k 0 to n minus 1, you get different values of z. Okay. And here we are taking a fractional power of a complex number. So when we take a fractional power of a complex number, we get a multi-valued answer. And so this is how we find the root of a complex number. And this actually comes out nicely from being sensitive to the fact that the Euler formula is a periodic function. Okay. Now this guy also has a very nice geometric interpretation, and you can think of these roots as being distributed on a circle of radius r to the power 1 over n. So these are the roots, dot, 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 dot. But the angle between every root is 2 pi by n. So for example, if you say, let's solve this equation. We are trying to find the cube root of unity. We find that, you know, Z can take the values of 1, e to the power 2 pi I by 3, and e to the power 4 pi I by 3. So this is, you know, if you didn't have the, if you didn't have access to the complex number, you'd miss two of these roots, right? And now I want to kind of come back to the comment that I earlier made about why we don't need anything other than complex numbers to find, you know, the arbitrary root of a number. Because, I mean, this is not a proof, but this is just like, you know, it's related to the fact that to this geometrical picture. So, and this geometrical picture is that for this guy, you know, there's a root here at 1, and there's a root here at here, and then of course, you know, if you think of these guys as arrows, so suppose I call this omega, then this is omega squared, then this picture just tells you immediately that the sum of the roots will add up to 0, right? Which is, you know, you don't really have to do any work to get this result. Okay. Anyway, I have 10 more minutes left, but I still want to get into a few more stuff, so I will rush through. But, okay. So inverse functions are very interesting, and the fact that the polar representation of a complex number is a periodic function of its argument means that when we take the logarithm is a multi-valued function. And let's discuss that. By the way, guys, you getting your bank account set up? Awesome. We all need money. Okay, so so z is e to the power I theta p plus 2 pi k, where k is an integer. Then the log of z is the log of the modulus. This is kind of the definition of the log, if you like. Plus I theta p plus 2 pi k, where k is an integer. So this z is not the same as this z. So given a z, we see that given a complex number, the log is not a single valued object. You know, it's a multiple valued object. There are other, so for example, we already saw how multiple valuedness arises when you take the root. So let's consider an example, for example, the square root of z. So the square root of z can be, if I think of z as, okay, r e to the power I theta, then we can think of this as, okay, let's just look at the principal branch, the principal value, then right, so okay, look at this. So I want to consider this as a function of r and theta. So I want to, for the time being, I want to keep r fixed, but I want to vary theta. So now as I vary, so suppose this is where we started and theta has some particular value. And then suppose we vary theta so that it goes from 0 to 2 pi. So then we see that, you know, when theta was 0, you know, this guy had, this was the value of this function. But when theta goes to 2 pi, because there's a half there, you know, r goes to minus, square root of r goes to minus square root of r, right? So the value of the function is this when you go around one circuit on the plane. So, okay, let's just, you start here and you go around. So this phenomena or this sort of, you know, property of a complex function where a complex function fails to come back to its same value when you go around a small circle once is known as monodromy. The word monodromy is used for a lot of different things, but this is one of the things. Mathematicians think of gauge transformation as monodromy as well. And probably it is in some fancy pants, you know, space. But anyway, coming back to, so this is, so now the, now if you go around twice, so you've come back once, and if you come back again, then theta goes from, you know, theta goes to 2 pi, 4 pi, and 4 pi by 2 is 2 pi, and therefore you come back to the original value, square root of r. So you have to go around this origin twice, you have to vary theta twice to come back to the same value. Now, you can easily verify yourself that if you, for this function, if you drew a circle which didn't go around the origin, this would not happen. And the way to do this is, so this is some point z naught, so you expand your function around epsilon is a small real number. You expand around z naught, and then vary theta from 0 to 2 pi, you'll see that the function does come back to its own value. So there's something special about this point around which you have a monodromy. And these points are called branch points. And functions with branch points, you know, they're multiple valued functions, i.e. they're not functions, or not in the traditional way. So say, but you say, no, I really want functions. I'm really attached to them. So there is a way of making them into nice functions, but by changing the space that they're defined on. And this is probably the first example of surgery in mathematics. And we'll look at some of this stuff in the tutorial tomorrow. So a way to make the square root of z a well-defined function is to actually take two copies of the complex plane and identifying first the branch point, and then making cuts along the both complex plane, but in a particular way. I'm going to use two colors. It's a little bit, so what you do is that you say that, okay, I start on this, on the real axis, and when I go back, when I go around 2 pi and hit the blue line, you know, it's kind of a dimensional portal. You know, we are, you know, carried up to this other complex plane. And then, you know, on this complex, and then we go around again. And when we hit the orange circle, we come back over here. So you know, all is well, because you are really not on the same complex plane anymore. And therefore, you know, your function is single valued. So, you know, it's a little bit like the TARDIS, you know, something like that. And so this is one way of dealing with it. You don't have to use this sort of surgery technique to deal with multiple valued functions, you know, and you know, you just keep in mind that they're multiple valued and everything is fine. But this is a nice geometrical way. This is because this allows you to construct this new kind of spaces on which complex numbers and complex functions are defined. And these spaces are called Riemann surfaces. So we'll work on Riemann surfaces tomorrow in the tutorial. But I want you guys to think about what would. Okay, before I give you the homework, let me tell you, give you a few more terminology. So these are called sheets. So this is a two-sheeted Riemann surface. And this is a branch point. The branch point is, I think it's called, it's degree 2 branch point or something, of order 2, I forget what. And now your homework, or what I want you to think about, is that what kind of Riemann surface would you need to make the log function a nice single-valued function. Okay, a lot of you know the answer. I'm sure most of you know the answer, but if you don't, you know, think about it. Okay. Okay. Any questions? I have one more minute left. Okay. Well, in that case, I shall see you tomorrow at 9 again.